From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Does the United States torture people suspected of terrorism? It depends on who you ask. Right now, two branches of the federal government are fighting over waterboarding. That debate centers around whether the simulated drowning technique crosses moral and legal lines. The U.S. Congress passed a bill that would ban waterboarding, but it didn't go so far as to call it torture. That bill is headed to the president's desk, and the president says he will veto it. For more, we have Christopher Bracey. He's a professor of law and of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the Senate passed the bill this week. What's the most recent news with waterboarding?
I think there are really two things going on here. First, there seems to be some growing sense of satisfaction among Democrats for having taken a stand against the apparent lawlessness, or at least alleged lawlessness, of the Bush administration. But the second thing is, I think a lot of people are waiting for the shoe to drop, the other shoe to drop.
Now, Senator John McCain was a victim of torture in Vietnam. He has made a lot of overtures towards the administration, very plain ones, saying it's not acceptable to torture, but he voted against this ban. How does he defend that move?
Yeah, it's a peculiar thing. What John McCain has said was that his vote was consistent with his early view that we ought not be limiting the military options available, and that those options ought not be constrained, and that using enhanced interrogation techniques are something that is useful to the military. But that, of course, contradicts what he has been saying on the campaign trail all along, which is that he's opposed to torture and opposed to these sorts of things. So there's a real inconsistency there, but John McCain seems to think that there is some way to reconcile his position.
So here's the huge question. Is waterboarding legal? What do you think?
Well, you know, that's a great question. You know, if you sort of go back and look at the history of waterboarding, at least in America, with respect to prosecutions and laws that have been passed, you get the growing sense that that it is unlawful, that it is illegal, that it's a violation of the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights, it's a violation of the U.N. Convention Against Torture, it's a violation of the United States Detainees Torture Act of 2005. The CIA has said that it has not used it since 2003. It prohibited the use in 2006, and so on and so forth. So you would think that there seems to be some consensus growing that it is unlawful, and yet the Attorney General has yet to define waterboarding as torture and illegal.
So why is it so hard to determine whether it's torture or not?
Well, you know, a lot of this has to do with interpretation of law and legal provisions, but it also has to do with the exigencies of war and what the military options are, and whether we want to feel as though we're constraining those options based upon some rule or some sort of moral obligation not to engage in certain enhanced interrogation techniques. I think ultimately this is a political question. It's certainly a divisive one, but if you look at just the law on the question, there seems to be a very clear indication that it is unlawful.
How has the United States structured when waterboarding is appropriate? How has that come up in the debate?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, if you go back to, say, 1947, you know, waterboarding was illegal, and you couldn't do it. We prosecuted a guy by the name of Yukio Asano and sentenced him to 15 years hard labor, Japanese war criminal, a war figure. But in the United States, there were, at least in the modern era, we're talking about, you know, sort of post-September 11th, there have always been some sort of guidelines on how we're going to be doing it and when we're going to be doing it. There seems to be an operating manual about the different kinds of waterboarding, the different stages of waterboarding that occur. And yet, despite all of this information and knowledge out there among the people who are using this enhanced interrogation technique, there is still yet to be a clear definition of what constitutes waterboarding and when it crosses the line. And so we haven't done that, and we specifically avoided doing that.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Christopher Bracey, a professor of law and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He also blogs at blackprof.com. Now we're going to take a broader look at how far the U.S. government can go in questioning detainees and defining what constitutes torture. With us today is Tara McKelvey. She's a senior editor at the American Prospect, and she's also the author of Monstering, Inside America's Policy on Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. Tara was the first U.S. journalist to speak with female prisoners from Abu Ghraib. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So how'd you get started on this kind of a project?
I was having dinner on Capitol Hill in the fall of 2004, and a congressional aide told me that she had heard that there were female detainees who had been held at Abu Ghraib. And I thought about the pictures that we had seen and how horrible they were, and then I thought, my God, what have they done to the women who were there?
I'm sure you've heard so many stories from different prisoners. Is there one that stands out that haunts you even?
I interviewed one man named, whom I call Nabil in my book, and he had been a lawyer, and he had actually come to the United States in 2001 for a UN General Assembly. I interviewed him in a hotel room in Amman, Jordan, and he told me about some of the interrogations that they had done on him and about the officers and the people who are interrogating him, the Americans. And during our conversation, he lifted up his pants leg and showed me red holes in his knee where he said electrodes had been placed during his interrogations. I was very, really shocked and appalled when I saw it.
What about the women? How were they treated?
The women that I interviewed would never say explicitly that they had been raped or sexually assaulted while they were held at Abu Ghraib or the other detention centers. It was too difficult for them to say that for all sorts of different reasons. They knew that if they had said something like that, they would go back to their families and they might be ostracized. And some of them were even in danger of honor killings, having their families go after them for, supposedly bringing shame on their family. But when I talked to them about the things that had happened, they would sometimes cover their faces or turn away or start shaking or crying when they described some of their experiences.
You mentioned how some of the people you spoke with were extremely angry against the United States. How did you make sense of whether or not they were telling the truth?
Of course, I was really careful and suspicious of all the stories that I heard. We're in a war, and this is a time when propaganda is going back and forth on both sides. It's difficult to get to the truth in this kind of a situation. I vetted the stories that I heard, and I sort of threw out a whole bunch of them. If it seemed like somebody had an ulterior motive or an agenda in our conversation, I would take notes, but I wouldn't pursue those stories. The ones that seemed valid were the ones that I pursued and tried to check as carefully as I could by checking their records with the Pentagon and other sources.
You also talk about what soldiers had to do. And the Abu Ghraib scandal was very public. Many people watched the hearings. But in the book, you have a moving interview with Sam Provance, one of the whistleblowers in the case. What did you learn from talking to him?
Sam was in Germany when we first started talking, and we talked on the phone quite a bit. And at one point, he sent me a CD that showed videos that had been taken at the prison. And they had set up kind of a party room where they played music, like Outkast and songs and things like that. And then they did these kind of rave scenes with this stuff where they called it robo-tripping, where they would drink Robitussin and then they would take amphetamines, over-the-counter pills, in order to sort of have this effects of LSD. And it showed this complete sense of lawlessness that was in the prison at the time. When they did these parties, they would also pretend to stab dummies, like what they pretended to be detainees. And I saw these images of these soldiers assaulting and attacking these fake bodies. It was disturbing, and it also gave some indication about what things were like at the prison during the time.
You even compared it to Lord of the Flies. Do you think there was a reason that order broke down in that case?
The people who were in charge of the prison were either not paying attention or they were deliberately allowing the things to take place. And at different times, I have different opinions about it. Brigadier General Janice Karpinski was officially in charge of the prison in early fall of 2003 when some of the atrocities took place. She was also in charge of 16 or 17 other detention facilities throughout Iraq, so she had to travel around the country visiting them. So the person who was in charge really wasn't there. That was part of the problem.
Your book really focuses on the detainees in Iraq, and the waterboarding issue has come up in regards largely to Guantanamo. Do you think that Abu Ghraib set the stage for a reexamination of how the United States pursues interrogations?
There's no question that Abu Ghraib is a key chapter in our history, and that it will be generations before this is, receding into the past. If you take the case of Guantanamo, where some of the more public, you know, the more famous, you know, interrogations have taken place, Guantanamo was in fact defined by Abu Ghraib, even though Guantanamo opened earlier. It was the Abu Ghraib scandal, which broke in April of 2004, that made people realize, you know, maybe we should think again about these types of interrogations that we're doing or the way we're treating the prisoners.
Now, where do you think the debate over waterboarding, harsh interrogations, and torture is going, based on the fact that you do have military sources as well as international sources? Do you think that there is going to be a resolution one way or the other in America's government about what constitutes appropriate interrogation?
I think the question that we've always had before us is the question that was posed by a CIA officer in residence at Texas A&M, a man named Robert Olson. He says, do we really want to be fighting a dirty war? And that's what these techniques are. We need to talk about it as a nation and come to some agreement on it. We seem to have come some ways towards deciding that we don't want to be doing these things. I think waterboarding is more a symbol than anything else, in terms it hasn't exactly been widely applied. But it's a way for us to talk about the types of techniques that we should or should not be using on prisoners and how we want to be seen by the rest of the world.
Do you think that there has been a negative effect about this whole debate on America's ability to operate within an international community?
Sure. I mean, there's always this feeling we need to be tough. We need to show how, you know, big and strong we are and face these terrorists and face them and show, you know, that we're not going to be pushed around. But on the other hand, the recent episode with the destruction of the CIA videotapes that showed some of the harsh interrogations, people were upset about the destruction of the evidence. So I think that there is some sense that maybe we should be reevaluating what we're doing and how we want to go forward with things.
Tara, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Tara McKelvey, a senior editor at the American Prospect and author of Monstering, Inside America's Policy on Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. Tara joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On today's Africa Update, President Bush is on the second leg of a five-nation Africa tour, and Kenya's rival political parties agree to review last year's disputed elections. Is an end finally near? For more, we've got Edmund Keller. He's director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, President George W. Bush is in Africa this week, and the trip is designed to highlight the administration's progress in combating disease and promoting good government. And the president has called this tour a mission of mercy. He's spotlighting his work on AIDS and malaria prevention.
It's in our interests that we deal with hopelessness, and it's our moral interest that we help. And this has been a labor of love. I told people we're on a mission of mercy.
How does that play with you?
Well, it seems to me that every president in recent memory wants to create a proper place in history for himself with regard to Africa. Bush seems to want to upstage Clinton in his last days when he made his trip to Africa. And he's going with the right kind of incentives, talking about good governance, poverty alleviation, and also talking about infrastructural development. Tanzania is a beautiful place. But it's very underdeveloped, and it's in the interests of the United States to help build that infrastructure, build the educational system, the road system and whatnot, because then Tanzania can play a larger role in the global economy.
How much influence can the president have, considering that he's only got months, not years, left in office?
On a personal level, he may not have much influence in the larger scheme of things. But anytime you promise a country like Tanzania $700 million for poverty alleviation, you know, infrastructural development, that has a ripple effect. There'll be other donors who want to complement that, and Tanzania will be a beneficiary of it, and probably a model for other countries. Ghana's already in that position. And also countries like Guinea-Bissau and, Cape Verde and Benin.
Now, the president has also responded to some criticism in general about whether or not the U.S. has helped with conflict resolution on the continent. How do you rate his ability to broker conflict?
Well, that's a tricky situation because I can understand the concerns of African leaders not wanting to be perceived as a pawn of the U.S. and not wanting to also be bullied by the United States, but at the same time, they have a real problem. They have their own security problems, and they have to figure out a way to deal with those. And if they can somehow maintain their integrity and get the kind of aid they need to beef up their own security apparatus, I think that's a good thing.
So speaking of conflict, let's turn to Kenya. Yesterday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was in Kenya to lend the administration support to the former UN chief Kofi Annan's mediation efforts. Washington wants President Mwai Kibaki and opposition leader Raila Odinga to strike a power-sharing agreement, and they hope a deal would end the violence that's plagued the nation since December's disputed presidential election.
There needs to be a governance arrangement that will allow real power-sharing, that will allow a coalition, indeed a grand coalition, so that Kenya can be governed.
So that was Secretary of State Rice. There's a lot of players on the scene right now. Inside Kenya, U.S. officials, international officials. How important is Secretary Rice in that mix?
Well, it shows that the United States is watching the situation and does want to offer a way out. Power sharing is never a perfect solution to anything. It's a short-term solution. From what I understand, they expect that this would be in place for about a year. Then there would be elections. Who's to say who the presidential candidates are going to be then, but at least there will be fresh elections. I think many Kenyans are saying they don't want either of these candidates now, particularly since they're so polarizing. So it'd be interesting to see whether or not either one of them can come out of this with any kind of political cachet.
Well, for the past 3 weeks, Kofi Annan has been trying to resolve the political conflict, and he spoke out about his efforts recently.
We are at the water's edge, and the last difficult and frightening step will be taken. I'm confident that in the interest of Kenya and its people, the parties will show the wisdom, flexibility, and leadership and foresight to conclude this agreement.
Professor, do you think that we're close to a resolution on this?
Not really. As I said, there might be a temporary resolution, and the U.S. has promised some material resources to help resettle people and to repair the damage that was done to property and so forth and so on. But again, that's not the same as building trust among the varying populations, and it'll take a long time before that trust is restored.
Want to move on to another controversy. The U.S. has decided to keep the headquarters of its new Africa Command in Germany. Many African countries have been wary of plans to base the command called AFRICOM on the continent. Liberia was the only African nation that offered to host AFRICOM. So this military command was created last year to unite the responsibilities shared by three other U.S. regional commands. Professor, briefly, tell me about AFRICOM's role on the continent. What was the U.S. desire, and how do you read the tea leaves on there not being an AFRICOM in Africa?
Well, that was always going to be a very tough sell, particularly after the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan with the U.S. African countries just didn't want to be gobbled up and subjugated by the United States and have their own agendas secondary to the U.S.'s. It's hard to figure out how the actual original concept of AFRICOM will play out. It originally was supposed to have a humanitarian and a sort of a nation-building and state-building kind of component, which would be run by State Department civilians and USAID civilians. But if they're not on the continent, it's hard to see how that will work.
Does this mean that the U.S. is giving up on part of a dream for engaging with Africa?
Not at all. I think if the U.S. Has short-term striking capability, military striking capability in various parts of Africa, it can still accomplish some of what it wants to do. Already, even today, the U.S. docks its naval ships in Mombasa in Kenya. It has access to airspace and air bases in Botswana. So it's there. It just won't be physically, the headquarters won't physically be on the continent.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the military capabilities are still going to be there, but the humanitarian side may not. Is that a bad bargain?
Well, in a way it is, because what the United States has to do is to create the impression in Africa that the United States is not only interested in its energy needs, its military needs in terms of fighting international terrorism, but also has the interests of African states at heart. And this whole thrust of poverty alleviation, expanded educational opportunities and all is a good thing, but we need to really follow through and make it work.
Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Edmund Keller is a professor of political science and director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at UCLA. He joined us at our NPR West studios. Journalist Nicola Tano spent more than 5 years living and reporting in Africa, but the relationship she cultivated with several women with HIV and AIDS became more than that of a reporter and subject. They became, under difficult circumstances, friends and confidants. Tano chronicles these women's stories in her latest book, No Place Left to Bury the Dead: Denial, Despair, and Hope in the African AIDS Pandemic. She told me how one young woman dealt with the disease and with her own past.
Seletso is in her early 20s, and she had kind of a wild youth and got pregnant very young, had her son Tabong, I think at the age of 18, and realized within about 6 months that he was severely disabled, and I think really wasn't quite sure how to deal with this, and basically ran away and left her son to be cared for by her family. And then about 5 years later, she began to fall ill and become sick, and she basically went home to her home village to die. And her son at that point had also, really his whole life had been quite ill. But fortunately, at that point in Botswana, the government was beginning to offer antiretroviral drugs. And so she was able, along with her son, to enroll in the antiretroviral drugs program. And so I met her just about the time that she started taking the drugs, both she and her son. And the transformation really was quite remarkable. I mean, when I first met her, she was rail thin and had just looked really, her body was just really ravaged. And Tabong was tiny. I mean, he was 5 years old, but he looked like an 18-month-old. He couldn't speak. He couldn't sit up. He couldn't walk. He couldn't talk. And really, to watch the transformation they went through over the period of a year was amazing. And at the same time, it didn't really solve a lot of the underlying problems. They were still very poor. She still was saddled with this really enormous burden of caring for a child who is both extremely physically disabled and HIV positive. And I think she really struggled with, you know, she wanted to live, and she still is doing very well, but she also, she had these sort of demons that kept pursuing her, I think.
You have a really interesting section where you talk about basically ethical decisions that reporters have to make. And in essence, you say, most reporters wouldn't think anything of taking a government minister out for a fancy dinner, but they wouldn't buy mealy meal and vegetables for a poor family. And yet they're extracting the same, if not more, amounts of information from the poor family as from the government minister. You made a decision in some of these cases to really try to help the family. How did you make that decision?
Well, I mean, I think I realized from the very beginning when I was starting the process of doing research for this book that I wasn't going to be able to maintain a completely objective journalistic stance, you know, if the idea was to go back again and again over a long period. And, you know, one of the advantages of writing a book as opposed to a newspaper article or something shorter is that you do have the luxury of being able to explain that relationship to the readers. But I do think we need to question some of our assumptions about people, particularly in the developing world. And I'm not sure that the rules that were designed in the West, in America, and that work very well in America, I think generally apply in situations where you really are talking about life and death situations. That said, I often was frustrated with my own inability to figure out how to help, even when I wanted to. You know, it was a difficult relationship often, trying to decide how to draw those lines, how to create those boundaries, because you do have to have boundaries of a sort. And I guess I did feel like I couldn't spend all of this time with these families and sort of walk away and do nothing.
When you look at this book that you have written, and it's got a fairly tough title, No Place Left to Bury the Dead: Denial, Despair, and Hope in the African AIDS Pandemic, do you think that this book has a lot of hope, or is this really about the death of a people, the death of nations?
Certainly during the years that I was in South Africa, and I think the years that in many ways this book primarily chronicles, there was new hope, and that is antiretroviral drugs did change enormously, not only people's individual lives and the lives of people who enrolled in the programs, but also I think the way that the disease and the epidemic was seen in Africa. I think it's no longer quite as scary. It's no longer quite as fearful a thing as it was 10 years ago when you were infected and it was a death sentence. It might be 2 years or 5 years, but you knew you were going to die and you knew you were going to die very soon in the future. And I think in that sense, yes, there is more hope today than there was before. But that said, there's still many parts of Africa, even many parts of Southern Africa, where people don't have access to these. And again, they don't in themselves solve all of the problems. And, you know, AIDS is very much tied to other problems of development, of poverty, of governance. And until those issues are addressed, not just by the international community, but also by countries themselves and communities themselves, you know, this will continue to be a problem. And I certainly don't see this issue, the problem of AIDS, going away anytime in the near future. This is something that will be with us for years and decades in the future.
You don't get into this in your book. It has happened or blossomed much more after the time window you look at. But so much of activism around AIDS today is centered around celebrity-based activism, whether it's Bono or Angelina Jolie. Is that a useful prism for Americans in particular to understand the disease?
I mean, I think it's been good in the sense that it has brought more attention to the disease. I mean, I think, you know, if you looked 7 or 8 years ago, people were dying in huge numbers, and there really was very little international recognition that this was a problem. And it wasn't really until about 2000, I would say, that the world kind of began to wake up to what was happening. And in that sense, I think celebrities have been useful. And I also think you have to divide celebrities. There are celebrities who I think have done very pragmatic things, for example, Bono and the Red Project, or President Clinton and his negotiation with drug companies to lower the price of antiretroviral drugs. And you know, they have really marshaled their star power in order to do those things, in order to push companies to donate money, in order to push drug companies to lower their prices. I do worry a bit that people come and get pictures of themselves taken with AIDS orphans, but they don't really understand what's happening.
On a very practical level, someone reading this book who doesn't really have a connection to AIDS through their family, through their friends, doesn't have a connection to Africa, what should they get out of it, or what do you want them to get out of it?
I mean, I think the most important thing I wanted people to get out of it is that to sort of humanize the people who are dealing with and humanize the places and the world in which this is happening. Because I think it's very easy, the statistics are so staggering, it's very easy to forget that there are real people behind it. And so I wanted to point out that they are real people. And they're not angels, they're not saints, they're ordinary people with flaws and problems and who make mistakes just like we do. But they are real people. And I think the other key thing that I would like people to come out of it with is that we need to be very careful about the assumptions that we make about other places and very careful about imposing those assumptions when we try to help. For example, I talk a lot about testing and HIV testing and the way in which a model that was very much designed in the United States to protect within the context of the American epidemic, which was centered, of course, early on among gay men, to protect the privacy of people. And that was a very alien concept and a very alien system that was then imposed on Africa. And I think a lot of African medical professionals that I spoke to really think that was not only ineffective, but actually damaging and may have increased the fear and the stigma around the disease. So we need to be very careful about the assumptions that we make.
Nicole, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Journalist Nicole Itano is the author of No Place Left to Bury the Dead, Denial, Despair, and Hope in the African AIDS Pandemic. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Australia has issued an official apology for historic wrongs against the nation's indigenous people, the Aborigines and the Torres Strait Islanders. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd addressed Parliament on Wednesday.
Today we honour the indigenous peoples of this land. We reflect on their past mistreatment. We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these, our fellow Australians.
The Prime Minister said the government was especially sorry for the treatment of what are called the stolen generations. For more than 60 years, Australian children were taken away from their parents and placed in state orphanages or sent to be raised by white families. The struggle of Australia's Aborigines for compensation, land control, and civil rights stretches back to at least the 1930s. But what will happen as a result of this apology? Will people's lives change? Joining me now is Kirsty Parker. She's the managing editor of the Koorie Mail, a newspaper that covers Australia's national Indigenous issues. She's based in Lismore, about 10 hours north of Sydney. Welcome.
Hello, Farai.
So it's great to have you on. And before we talk about the apology, I want to know a little bit more about you. Tell me about your parents and your connection to Indigenous Australia.
Sure. I identify as an Aboriginal woman from Australia. I'm a Yuwalari woman, which is essentially my mother's language group, which comes from northern New South Wales. My dad is an interloper from England. He's a Pom. So I have mixed heritage. I identify, though, as an Aboriginal woman because that's the experience that I've known. I was born and raised in Australia.
For someone who was in the U.S. and doesn't know very much about Indigenous issues in Australia, where do you see a parallel with the U.S. Black experience or the U.S. Native American experience?
From my understanding of the Native American experience, I guess that would be the closest parallel that I'm aware of. I understand that there is in the U.S. a reformatory or dormitory generation where First Nation Americans were removed from their families. And that's essentially a pretty apt description of Australia's stolen generations, which are basically Aboriginal, mostly Aboriginal, but some Torres Strait Islander people that were removed from their families as children, essentially from probably, you know, the early 1900s right through until about 1970 under government policies and laws. And it was certainly governments that enabled Aboriginal children to be removed from their families. In most cases, it was part Aboriginal children or children who had mixed heritage. And these children were essentially removed because there was a prevailing belief that because they had some non-Aboriginal heritage, that they perhaps could be effectively salvaged, that they might be able to be educated and to become so-called worthy, you know, members of Australia's society.
There's also a question of language where on some of the things that you've written, you talk about black and white Australians. And when you say black, you mean Aboriginal or Indigenous, correct?
Yes, I mean Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yeah. How does the language, I mean, in the U.S. we use one language of race, and black usually means, you know, a descendant of enslaved Africans. It's come to mean, you know, a somewhat broader array of things like that. But why is the word black, is it a choice? Is it what was imposed? Is it both?
In many cases, people were described as black or black fellows in the early, you know, by early settlers because people were dark-skinned. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians do, for most part, I believe, identify as black Australians. But I guess it's more, here in Australia, some people are reluctant to leave it at black because they say it's not just about our skin colour, it's also about our First Nation status. I guess we shorthand it to say that we are black Australians, but people generally prefer to be known by their language group. I mentioned earlier that I'm from the Yuwalari people of northern New South Wales. There were, you know, in excess of 350 different language groups before white people came to Australia, and more and more people are identifying with their particular language group.
There have been so many moments in American history where there have been challenges or conflicts or absolute heartrending moments where a black person in America could not be fully vested in citizenship, sometimes not vested at all. Do you feel Australian?
That's a really interesting question because it has come up certainly in the context of this national apology. I personally feel, and a number of people that I have spoken to, Aboriginal people, have said to me before this day, and we're talking about the day of the National Apology, I never felt Australian in the sense of the, I guess, the modern Australian kind of identity. I've always felt like an Aboriginal person from this country. I've identified with my traditional country, but not in a sense that I'm an Australian. Because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people suffer serious levels of disadvantage in all sorts of social indicators, health, housing, education, employment, etc. And it's those sorts of things that, I guess, make people feel as if they are included in Australian society. This apology, you know, has obviously generated a lot of debate about whether, as a symbolic measure, as a gesture, it will achieve any real practical outcomes for Aboriginal people. And there's been a broader discussion about whether, you know, we should concentrate on the symbolic or the practical. Aboriginal people don't see why they should have to choose.
If you had to choose something, even something small, that this struggle has given the world in terms of knowledge about how to resolve differences or knowledges about how to negotiate these constraints that people have put on each other in this growth of human society, what has your experience as an Australian, the experience that led up to this apology, offered to other people who are looking around at the struggles over Indigenous rights and race and ethnicity in their own countries?
I would just have to say, I mean, it's been a real eye-opener for me as an Aboriginal person. Aboriginal people have grown to be extremely cynical about the words of government, about promises that are made. The fact that there has been this consultation, and it was an unprecedented level of consultation with members of the Stolen Generation, people who were literally removed, were asked, what would it personally mean to you if we apologised? The government was at pains to say, we ask the people that this apology matters to most. I mean, the words that the Prime Minister that you played were part of it. He also apologised very specifically for the removal of Aboriginal kids, for breaking up families, for the indignity and degradation inflicted on a proud people. That acknowledgement is just absolutely massively powerful for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. It says, you acknowledge our experiences where previously, you know, I know older members of our community who are in their 60s and 70s have said to me, I have been through my entire life looking into the eyes of white Australians and I know that they think I'm a liar. Now to have people being validated after, you know, 6 or 7 decades of that kind of denial is exceptionally powerful.
On that note, Kirsty, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Kirsty Parker is the managing editor of the Koori Mail, a newspaper that covers Australia's national Indigenous issues, and she joined me from Lismore in New South Wales, Australia. John Edgar Wideman has written about the history of lynching in America, about the bombing of the Black Radical Collective Move, and even the racial climate surrounding the epidemic of yellow fever in the 18th century in Philadelphia. In all, he's penned more than 20 works of fiction and nonfiction. Now Wideman has turned his attention to the sickness of racism as seen through the eyes of the revolutionary and theorist Frantz Fanon. The new novel is called Fanon, and John Edgar Wideman is here to tell us more. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. It's a weirdly warm and beautiful day in New York.
Let's talk about your book. You write, and this is a quote from the book, Fanon's story remains relatively untouched, forgotten like novels on the bestseller list the year he died. So when did you first become familiar with his work, and why did you decide to write about him now?
Like a lot of people, I carried Wretched of the Earth in my back pocket, making sure the title showed as a kind of revolutionary symbol back in the 60s. I read him at that point. I lost him over the years. That is to say, I didn't teach him. I didn't read any more of his books. But about 6 years ago, I was in Martinique, and Mr. Fanon was born in Martinique, and I saw a stenciled portrait on a wall of a man who looked somewhat familiar. I thought it was just a political poster of some kind. But the face haunted me, and I didn't recognize it immediately. And then the next day, I realized that I had been face-to-face with Frantz Fanon. And that started me to thinking, started me to reading again, and the result is Fanon.
Fanon is not a traditional character in this book. He floats through largely as someone who is thought of rather than someone who acts. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to structure the book and how he appears in the book.
Mainly, I had this idea for the book. Fanon was an important person to me. He was a kind of hero for a while. In many ways, his life parallels mine. He came from a divided country, a country divided into black and white. His experience was colonial. Mine was urban. But I recognized in him a kind of brother, if you will. Still, Fanon, for me, was a kind of idealized person, an idealized persona. And I wanted to track down what made him so attractive to me.
So you're comparing yourself in this book to a great revolutionary. And in this book, you write, almost 30 years ago, I tried to write a book I hoped might free my brother from a life sentence in the penitentiary. Everything written after that book, and basically it didn't work, everything written after that book worked even less. Are you upset that words can't change more?
Well, I'm upset, and I'm also I also know better than to think that they really can. What words change, the power of words is to change the individual sensibility, to change the individual conscience. And every now and again, there are words which aligned with politics and good luck and external conditions in the world, there are words and phrases and slogans that really can manifest change.
What specifically, if you had to pick a phrase from him, what would it be?
Would be, make of me a man who questions. Make of me a man who questions. And I would certainly put that on a T-shirt and wear it around.
What keeps you writing about race? Not just because you're an African-American author, but because of what it brings to your work. What keeps you writing about race in one form or the other?
Well, I want to understand it, as my friend Fanon, as my idol Fanon. I want to understand it. And it is quite complicated, but in another way, it's quite simple. And when I say race, I should stipulate, I don't mean simply black and white. By race, I mean any idea or notion that divides human beings into more than one kind. And then the next step of race and racism and racialized thinking is to figure out a scheme through which or by which, because of this difference, manufactured difference, one group or another can take advantage of other groups. So it sits over our shoulder, and it's part of what's the motivation for our going into Iraq. It's keeping young black men in prison in a totally disproportionate way. It's the cause of abuse against women. Race is a villain, and I wish I could wave a magic wand, but I can't. It's too deeply embedded in our nature.
You mentioned how race is linked to, among many other things, the prison system, and you've had, I'm sure, much too much experience with it, more than you'd like, with both your brother and your son incarcerated. You have sections in your book where your brother is, you and your brother are talking about the nature of hope and whether hope can be debilitating in the context of being someone who's incarcerated. How does your personal experience inform your how you think about an issue that's this big sociological, anthropological, financial, government issue, and then the real hardcore issue of how do you relate to family who are incarcerated?
Well, you've described in a way what Fanon, the novel, is all about, and maybe a central vein in all my work. And I think it's totally consistent to see that if race is a way of immuring, isolating, or dividing people, then naturally, institutions grow up in society that formalize that cutting off. And I've felt that each time I go home to Pittsburgh to visit my brother in prison.
At the same time, though, there's this question of who's on the other end of the aggression. And you write about your mother as well, looking out over a window at streets that are not clean and not safe. And how does that loop affect you?
Well, for me, she's not completely constrained. She is as much a hero in the book as I envision it, as Fanon. Somehow this woman, who's very much like my mother, meets Fanon. And in my mind, it would be a meeting for the ages, because it's a meeting of my two parts of me, the intellectual, the writer, the activist, who has set out to try to change the world, and then that world itself, represented by this woman who was my who brought me onto the earth, and who, in her life and in her consciousness, embodies a folk wisdom. But she's not constrained because she had the power to love. And that love affected all the people around here. I lost my mother just in the last 10 days.
And, I'm so sorry.
It was an extraordinary experience to go back to Pittsburgh and hear testimony after testimony from family and friends about her impact upon the community, and for me to observe how powerfully her presence was still around. This book becomes a kind of memorial. When I wrote it, I was thinking about sitting with my mother and reading it to her. And so I won't get to a chance to do that in the way I would have liked to have done it. But it just means that she'll be listening in another way.
Well, Mr. Weidman, I'm really sorry about your loss. I mean, I'm glad you made the time for us, considering.
That's what she would have me do. That's how I was raised. But thank you again, and thank you for your condolences.
John Edgar Weidman is the author of the novel Fanon. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.